Hey everyone, this is Jamel Curry. Thanks for tuning in. Today we're back with another episode in our Coca Dona Training Talk mini-series as we get closer to Aravaipa's inaugural Coca Dona 250 on May 3rd. Coca Dona is a 250-plus mile trail race that starts in the outskirts of the Sonoran Desert in Black Canyon City and climbs up into the Ponderosa Pines in the high-altitude mountain town of Flagstaff. The course connects amazing landscapes and iconic towns along the way. These Coca Dona Training Talk episodes will be hosted by our friend Shelby Farrell at Gooder. Shelby will be running Coca Dona this year. She has run a 100-miler before, but this will be a whole new experience for her. So she sat down with several different runners to get some training advice and learn more about their own preparation and race strategy before the big day. In today's episode, Shelby chats with the long-distance legend himself, Speed Goat Carl Meltzer. Carl actually had to pull out of the race due to an injury, but regardless, he's one of the best people to talk to when getting ready for a race like Coca Dona. Enjoy the episode.
Hey, Carl Meltzer. It's an honor to be speaking to such a legend. I do want to start by reading this paragraph that I found out about you on a random blog.
Nice.
It's about your Appalachian Trail FKT, and I absolutely loved it. So it said, he changed out his training regimen, and that, according to him, made the difference. This time out, he capped each night with one or two beers and left from rest stops with rainbow-colored Spree candy, Three Musketeers chocolate bars, and bacon in his pockets. To save time and keep his energy up, he typically slept less than 7 hours a night and instead had an energy drink every 10 miles, downing about 5 a day. When on another day, his support crew found him napping, they gave him a pint of ice cream for a boost. And just like, what a hero. So is that true?
That's a little skewed. The beer after each day was true. I mean, that a lot of times I didn't even really finish that beer. It was more like just the taste of a cold beer, you know, after a long day on the trail was great. I guess you might have read that from New York Times, because they're the ones that glorified beer and candy. And sure, I ate some candy out there. I ate a lot of things out there, but it wasn't all candy. It was mostly whatever my crew could come up with, whatever I was sort of craving. But so it was anything from a cinnamon bun to a gel to chicken strips to, I mean, there was a little bacon in there. But it was really, you know, most of the mandarin oranges was a popular thing, like canned. Just the sugar and the moisture was good. So I ate a lot of different stuff out there. I think a lot of the articles went a little over the top when they said I did it mostly on candy, but that's not really the whole case. I mean, I drank a lot of recovery drink from First Endurance Ultra Gin, which is, you know, that's really nutritious stuff. So it was really varied what I ate on the AT, but ultimately the AT is really about getting calories in, you know, and that was mostly, for me, it really didn't matter what I was eating. I wasn't moving that fast. So your body's able to process those types of calories. Now, if I'm racing 100-miler or maybe 250 or whatever, my nutrition would be different. It would be more race normal, which for me is like gel across the board, water, and you know, maybe some soup bouillon, or you know, maybe a nibble of pineapple or something like that. But generally speaking, I can keep it very simple when I race. So the AT thing was it was entertaining to say the least, on from all the stuff that I heard. But I ate some ice cream. I did down a pint, whole pint at one time at one point. I did not the half gallon challenge at the halfway point. That was a little overwhelming, but I mean, it was an incredible adventure, and it's amazing that it's been 5 years that it's been done already, you know. And it's amazing that not just yourself, but a lot of people have said that they saw that on Netflix, the film, and it's still going. That blows my mind, because, you know, I mean, I never claimed to be a film star, movie star. But to see it still going 5 years later is really cool. Red Bull did a great job with that. And, you know, it shows obviously that it's still showing. So that was really a pretty, pretty cool honor to do that. And for Red Bull to do it my way. You know, I didn't have to do interviews after each day. I didn't have to, you know, do what they wanted me to do. I said, if we're going to make a film, then I'm going to run the AT and or do the, you know, whatever hike EAT for an FKT and you can film it. So there was a difference there between what I was obligated to do and what they were going to do for me. So yeah, they were awesome. And obviously I got lucky and got it done.
Yeah, that's fucking great. So yeah. I was bummed to hear that you will not be making it out to Cocodona this inaugural year. What happened?
Yeah, I ran a race called the Badger Mountain 100. It was, I guess now it's been 10 days ago. And, you know, I was doing all right. I didn't go into it in very good shape. I've had a kind of a tough winter for training. If you can believe this, I probably averaged 30 miles a week all winter since about mid-November. So that wouldn't be very much training. I'm sure you know that.
Oh.
A lot of those miles were not even really running. They're mostly hiking. I had a minor calf strain. I had a minor groin strain. Just stupid crap that kind of slows you down. Most runners understand that. So I went into the Badger Mountain 100, not very fit. I went through 50 miles in 8:22, which was okay for me, slower than my norm, but it was okay. But I, at mile 70, I decided it was up a real steep climb, got over the top, a little wobbly, already sore, of course, from under training or just from running 70 miles. I kicked a rock and it made me stumble and do a dance and flip around and do all kinds of things. And then I was slammed to the ground like a rag doll. And when it happened, I didn't really notice that my toe was really the problem. It was more like I slammed my hand, both my hands went down pretty hard. Had I not had bike gloves on, my hands would be shredded, but my bike gloves saved me. But I went down hard on my shoulder. You know, it was a hard fall, to be honest with you. And I continued on. And as I got later in the race, because I was walking because of that, I got pretty rattled when I went down that hard. And I walked for quite a while. I was sort of out of the race to win it, so I didn't let that time bother me. And when I got to mile 82, I ended up actually dropping the race because I was too cold. Typically, I go on the edge of being warm enough, and I'm usually running, jogging, so I'm staying warmer, right? But I was walking. I walked 11 miles, and I got pretty cold. And that was really the reason I dropped out of the race, not the toe. However, and I hate to do that because that's kind of like, you can call it wimping out or not. I mean, I could have stayed in front of the fire and got warmer, but the bottom line was I knew I would get cold because I had no other clothing to put on. Anyway, I got a ride back to the finish line and I jumped in my car, which I had a bed in to sleep, just relax. Couldn't fall asleep, of course, because I was pretty wired. But about an hour after being in the car, my toe started throbbing, my left big toe. And, you know, it was elevated, of course, but that did nothing. One painkiller did nothing. And after, you know, punched the top of my car, it was pretty excruciating. I finally just said, I'm going to go to the ER. So I went to the ER about 7:30 in the morning and broken toe, right? So yeah, I left the ER and started my journey back to Utah. And I was, you know, obviously pretty disappointed, but, you know, shit happens. I've broken my shoulder twice. I've broken my ribs. I've broken wrists. I've broken arms. All running. So just another injury. When you run as long as I do, you break things once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah. That
shit happens, you know?
Yeah. And 250 miles is plenty of time for shit to go wrong. So
yeah. And
yeah. What can we learn from this?
Well, I mean, I don't know if you can really learn much from it. It's just the fact that, you know, for anyone late in 100, whether it's the fastest guy in the field or the slowest person, you get stumbly late in the race. And especially if it gets techy. This race wasn't particularly technical. It was where I fell, but most of it was pretty smooth. But, you know, I stubbed the wrong rock and down I went. So, you know, ironically, what was also weird is that the Sunday before the race, I was running just one of my last taper runs. And I also stumbled on a rock and slammed on my left shoulder near my house and I landed on my left hip. So think of a 4-pound hammer slamming into your left hip. On Monday, I couldn't walk. Tuesday, I ran 150 yards. I couldn't go any further. Wednesday, I jogged 3 miles. And if I said to myself, if I was pain-free, then I'll go to Washington. And it was pain-free Wednesday morning. I mean, I wasn't fast. It was slow. But I'm like, well, I'll just go. I know how to do it. And then I went. And then ironically, I fall again on the left side. And, well, you know, bad things happen in threes. This time, it kind of happened in fives. Maybe that happens when you get older or past 50 years old. I don't know. But, yeah, it was, I mean, you know, what can I say? I tend to put things behind me too. I'm not going to like dwell on this and worry about it. I mean, I'm bummed about Cocodona, but you know, I'll bounce back.
You know, yeah. Absolutely. There's other races. You did mention wearing bike gloves. Is that something that you do often?
Always wore bike gloves. There's a lot of reasons for it. Number one, obviously, to save your hands when you crash. That's part of it. But there's a lot of ways you can use bike gloves. Number one, if it's on the edge of being too cold, it keeps you a little warmer. But I stuff gels in my bike gloves.
Oh, clever.
So when I carry gel, you know, I have a waist pack, a Spiga waist pack, but that carries some stuff. But I like to carry stuff kind of yard sale. But with two gels in each hand, that's good for about an hour and 40 minutes of energy. And then I have small pockets in my shorts. I can have 12 gels on me, 14 gels on me. You'd never know it. But that's just one way to carry extra gels. And then if bike gloves, some of the, I don't know if you've ever done any like backcountry skiing or skimo racing or something. A lot of those gloves have, they fold over the mitten, you know?
Yeah.
But if you have gloves like that too, that's also, you don't need to wear, have a separate pair of gloves. You already have them on you. You're carrying them on you. So I kind of use it as an efficiency tool too. You know, not many people do it. And then once every time someone shows me a flapper on their hand when their skin comes off, I'm like, should have worn your glove. So it's a good way to, like I said, good way to carry stuff. And again, it's right at your hands and your fingertips instead of digging through a pack, a vest pack or something.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great tip. You mentioned skiing. You're talking to a fellow ex-ski bum here.
Excellent. Me too. So, excellent.
Yeah, I know you've referenced your bartending days at Snowbird and applying that to your swiftness, moving through aid stations. Can you elaborate on that? How do you execute moving through an aid station quickly? Are you communicating to a pacer crew ahead of time?
Yeah. Well, I don't do pacers, so I'm usually on my own. My wife will crew me when she's available. She doesn't go to all the races. Like, she didn't go to Badger Mountain, which is fine. I don't mind running by myself. My focus when I get to an aid station is, number one, the day before, you know, my drop bag situation. I don't have things in my drop bag that I might need. I only have things that I will use. In other words, I don't have an extra pair of shoes and socks and, you know, extra this, extra that. I just carry what I would need. Like I said, I got cold in the race, right? Probably should have had an extra shirt in that bag, right? That was one of the very, very few times that would have been nice. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when you're trying to race to win, you don't normally do that. You try to keep it as efficient as possible. What I do when I come to an aid station, when I know it's coming up, you know, I do my inventory, basically. I write numbers on my arm, depending on how far distances are, maybe. What aid stations have my bag. Just little notes, you know, it's written on me. I'm not carrying anything. It's just, I just wash the ink off later. That tells me, I might say aid station 4 and I might have a 5 next to it, which means take 5 gels. You know, when you go gels only, it's very, very simple. So you're not thinking, you know, I got to mix this drink. I got to grab 3 gels. I got to get a Clif Bar and, you know, all these other things. I don't do those other things. I just keep it simple. So I'll write that stuff on my arm. But again, I do my inventory before I get to the aid station. Okay, I've got 2 gels still on me. I need 5. That means I need to get 3 more. And I go to that. First thing I do is I make sure my bottles get full and I put them back in my pack. Don't forget that, because I've forgotten that shit before in the past too, even with my crew. But do that first. It's your water, so that's out of the way. And then the rest is all on you grabbing your bag. In other stations where there is no drop bag, it's always going to be just fill water for me, and that's it. I'm not looking at the tables. I'm not really grabbing food off the tables. I might grab some soup if it's late or something, but it's rare. So that's, I mean, how long does it take to grab a few gels and get water? 30 seconds. So my downtime on aid stations typically for 100 milers, always less than 20 minutes.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, and if you think about it, like I know Javelina, you know, so Javelina is pretty easy because it's loops like that. But again, like, you know, you'll see a lot of people stopping and resting and changing their shoes or grazing at the table. And then their crew starts talking to them if they have the crew of 4, which we see often. That's a big mistake, because then they're all asking you questions. They're all saying, how do you feel? Does that hurt? Do you need this? Do you need that? And all of a sudden 10 minutes have gone by and you could be a mile down the trail already. So my suggest crew is never more than 2 people. One to drive, the other to navigate, you know, for their locations. And then their goal was to just not really, at least for me, is to not ask the goal is to not ask any questions. Don't ask what hurts. Of course I'm sore. No shit. Right. So those kind of things, I try to keep those things out of my head and just keep focused on going forward, you know, and not stopping and not, you know, never sitting down. I mean, I've sat down before, you know, tie my shoe or something, but it's, I never sit down to rest because that's just wasted moments. And usually in my career, I've been running, you know, I'm older now and I don't run to win as much anymore, but earlier in my career, it was always, I'm running to win, you know? So the faster you beat your buddies out of the aid stations, the slower you have to run to still beat them. And my last 100-mile win, which was No Business 100 in October, Grant Barnett, who's he's young, much younger than I am. He's a good fast runner. He was a faster runner, but my aid station time was about 15 minutes. His was about an hour.
Wow.
45 minutes, right? So, I mean, there's your math right there, right? He was constantly trying to catch up to me. Then he'd pass me and get a little ahead. I'd come in the aid station, grab my water. He'd still be sitting there. I'd leave and catch up to me again. And that trend was common throughout that whole race that day. We were together for 85 miles until I finally broke him when I got just barely ahead of him at an aid station. So, you know, the efficiency factor over my career has gotten better and better, even though I've gotten older. Just a better way to race, to take minutes off your time without actually running faster.
Yeah, absolutely. So for Coca Dona, were you going to, there's no way you were going to eat all gels for Coca Dona.
Well, I don't know, you know, I've been known to eat a lot, but no, you're probably right. I would have had a little more fruit. I probably would have done some mandarin oranges. Probably would have done some soup. You know, and my focus on that race, I didn't have a goal time, because I didn't really know what to expect. I mean, I could say I'm going to try to average 4 miles an hour. 4 miles an hour would get me about 65 hours at 250 miles. So, you know, that was a realistic, I think for me, it was a realistic goal, even with sleep time. But at the same time, number one, I don't really do that well with sleep deprivation. So maybe that would affect me. Maybe it won't. I don't know, you know, because I've never done it. But my goal would have been just to go as far as until I'm tired. And then when I'm tired, sleep for, you know, like only like an hour. I wouldn't say I'm going to sleep for 5 or 6 hours. I would try to go down for 1 hour, have my wife or, you know, curling me, set the alarm and get up and move again. That would have been sort of my plan. But as far as exactly what I was going to eat, it would have been fast fuel race stuff for the most part. You don't want to see me eating a cheeseburger or like people eat chicken McNuggets in races. It drives me nuts. They're disgusting. but we see it a lot, you know, it's common to eat, not just chicken McNuggets, but any kind of fast food crap. But, you know, I would have had the same kind of strategies 100 and kind of see how I survived, you know, and there's a lot of walking to be done in a race like that. I mean, I'm a good fast walker, which is evident by the Appalachian Trail thing. I mean, I can walk just about 4 miles an hour fairly comfortably without it feeling weird, you know? So I think that would have been a positive for me. I wouldn't have focused on the guys who are racing to win, which would be Mike McKnight, would have been Versteeg. Is it Mike Versteeg? Is that his first name? But either way, he's done the AZT and he's, you know, he's had the record on that. So he's no slouch. McKnight was, you know, I wouldn't focus on trying to stay with him. I would have done all, it would have been all me and whatever I would have done. It would have been my plan and not someone else's. That's another thing. Even my clients that I coach, I don't tell them to focus their race on others. It's all about you and what you do properly. And whatever, if you have a good run, your time will reflect what you got, you know? It's tough strategy. Not ever doing it before.
Right. Yeah. I'm right there with you. I think
you're in the same boat, right? I mean, that's probably the same thing. You did a great 100, but you know, when you get past 120, 130 miles, even you're going into the unknown zone of, you know, how long is it going to take you from there? I mean, that's the fun part about doing it is the unknown zone, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
How much can I learn from this race? A whole hell of a lot, I'm sure.
Yeah. You'll probably, you know, I've coined that phrase, 100 miles is not that far. But I coined that phrase after I did the AT in 2008, my first run at it, because once I did that, I mean, I was like, you know, I just felt like 100 miles isn't that far, you know, when you go 46 days going 50 miles a day, that 100 miler seemed, because it's one effort, one day effort, it's like, man, I mean, I can a mile or off the couch, piece of cake. You know, finishing 100 miles is easy for me, but doesn't mean it doesn't hurt, but it's, the distance does not intimidate me at all. Not anymore anyway. I've done like 75 of them, so it's, yeah.
Crazy. Yeah, I'm know, curious, right? How do you keep track? Do you have an Excel sheet with all of your...
I do. I've got my Excel sheet and I've got my, you know, I don't keep super tight track of it, but I got a record of all my stuff and you know, it's easy to look at ultra sign up too, but I keep track of my stuff and what records are broken. If you look at my whole, you know, 25 years of a spreadsheet, if you looked at the big picture, what's pretty interesting is that everything that was in red is a record that I broke. And when you look at my career, just, you know, from a blurry vision kind of look at it, you can see where I was in my peak, right? Because all this more to this record, whatever. And then all of a sudden, not many red at the bottom. It gets slower. But yeah, I mean, I keep track, you know. I don't dwell on it. I'm not worried about breaking and winning another 100 this year to make it 20 years. I mean, it would be wonderful. You know,
you got it.
A lot of people like that streak. You know, Carl, you got to keep going for the streak. But, you know, all streaks come to an end sometime. So whatever happens, it happens. I mean, now it's not going to happen. It's going to be another late season deal if I do it. So
all right. I'm rooting for you, though, Carl.
Well, I know everybody's rooting. So we'll see. You know, I hope I can do it. But and I'm going to give it a shot. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Ah, that's so awesome. Let's see. I think those are really some of my big questions. I mean, I really was nerding out on the Trail Runner Nation podcast during a long run last week. And you had me chuckling because I've gone both ways. I've carried too much and been like, I really didn't need that. And I've also forgotten to carry a long sleeve shirt and been freezing for miles. So
right.
What do you think your strategy would have looked like for 250? Would you just have that custom waist belt or a little
bit? Yeah. So I thought about that in Cocodona. There was one leg that was like 18 or 20 miles long or something. It's like mm-hmm. 30 and 50 or something like that in there. I would have thought about the temperature, obviously during the day. I'm going to assume it would be pretty warm down there that time of day. So my waist pack is 2 18-ounce bottles, and that's not going to last 20 miles if it's hot. I'm the camel to begin with, but that wouldn't last enough. Even if I slammed 20 ounces before I left the aid station, which would hold me for a little while, and then I had those two bottles and kind of tried to catch up when I stopped again. My goal was to go down there in April sometime around now, or maybe a little after now, was to go look at that 20-mile section and see if there was a place I could scoop water.
Mm.
I don't know if that's possible or not. I have not. I mean, now it's too late anyway, but that was one thing I wanted to do, because if I would have been able to scoop water, the rest of the course I could have done on those two bottles.
Yeah.
I don't like vests, so I would never have carried a vest anyway, because I think they're hot. I think it gives the opportunity to carry too much crap. I also would have assumed that as we gained elevation, especially once we get towards Flagstaff after Sedona, nighttime would be colder, you know. So you'd have to like check that out. I'd probably have my wife would have been crewing me. But I would have used my other piece of advice is to use your drop bags even if you have crew, because what if your crew gets a flat? What if they don't make it? Then you still have your supplies. So I would have, you know, I might have packed a little of that extra shirt in maybe Cocodona because my wife would pick it up, that kind of thing. But yeah, it would have been about temps. If it would have been a stormy, I mean, Arizona raining in Arizona is pretty rare.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Like, but, that. You know, I'd have just, it would just be what the weather going to be. If it's just going to be hot and dry and sunny the whole time, then I probably would have gone pretty light, but I would have been prepared for the evening. A wind jacket is always important, and a super light hat would always be important. And again, Flagstaff is higher elevation. So if you hit that at the wrong time of day or night, flag could probably get down to 30 if it was a cold spell. So you could expect being treated at 30 degrees or even 40 degrees, you're going to get cold pretty fast if you're not moving that fast, which I wouldn't suspect anyone will be moving that fast at mile 200.
Right. So,
you know, you want to sort of think about preparing for that, I think.
You mentioned like taking down a bunch of water at an aid station. Do you practice taking in a lot of water at once or like slowly? I like to call it microdosing on water throughout.
Right. Well, I like to think as your fuel was an IV drip. Mm-hmm. So it would be slow sip, you nibble and sip kind of thing. But the reason for me to drink like a lot at one aid station would be simply because I did have a long leg coming up. So you don't like get halfway through that long leg and then be out. And you have no, and you're, I mean, then you're kind of stuck and you'll right. go this next 10 miles with nothing. That could be more of a struggle. If you pound a little before you go and you're still on point with your hydration, then at least you shouldn't fall too far behind in theory. you know, your electrolyte balance is always important. I mean, those would always be carried on me the whole time, just little capsules. I usually use salt stick or 60S caps. They both work about the same profile. So, you know, that would have been, I mean, basic strategy. It's not complicated, you know, for me to go with that strategy, but that's what I would have done. I wouldn't have tried to change anything. The cardinal rule is don't do anything new in an ultra. So, you know, I wouldn't have really done anything newer than I normally do anyway.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, there's going to be a lot of new things for me because
a lot of people got to find themselves out there.
It's going to be a very transformative run, we'll say.
Well, you focus too on another thing is like, you know, obviously you don't want to get lost. And my guess is download the app on your phone to follow the trail. I've never done that in my entire life. So I would have to do that. I would do it obviously if I had to, but to be honest with you, I'd be looking at markers. And when you come to a junction and you aren't sure, you stop and take the time to make sure that you don't screw that up. Because how many times, you know, early in my career, I made those mistakes. I don't now, but I would, you know, you run down the trail and you don't see a marker. Well, I'll see one. And before you know it, you've gone 5-10 minutes the wrong direction. Takes 5 more 10 minutes to get back and you lost 20 minutes of time. So that extra, you know, minute or two to just to turn around and say, okay, I'm going the right way is important. Especially when you're late in a race, when you're all delirious.
Right.
You can, am I going the right way? North, you know, I don't know. So that's really important to stay focused when you come to any junction. You just make sure you get it right. I don't know if Jamil marks wrong way or not, but you know, in my race that I put on, we have different colored ribbon for the wrong way and we make it for idiots. So, no offense to anyone out there, but that's just how you mark it. You mark it for idiots, you know, otherwise it's like the last thing you want to hear is someone get to the finish line and say, I got lost out there. What the hell was wrong with that?
No, dude, it's so easy. I actually missed a turn at the North Face Endurance Challenge 50 miler. I asked a volunteer which way to go and she pointed the wrong way. She thought I was one of the 50K runners or something. And
right.
I ended up getting driven back. It was a fucking mess. But
right. Yeah, so that's, I know that
like
feeling,
my biggest
though.
Nightmare right there.
And that's another RD mistake, race director mistake, is that every single person that works in aid station knows where everyone's supposed to go. They know what color their bib number is for whatever race. I mean, North Face, I've run it too. And they put 5 different color bibs on one thing or ribbons on one thing. And I understand how they're, you know, where they're coming from with that, but that can be confusing. And if the aid station people don't know, you know, all those little basic things, it can be frustrating for a runner. And especially in your situation, they tell you to go that way and they think you're, you know, that would have pissed me off.
Oh, man. Yeah, Carl.
I bet. but that's, you know, you learn from that. You learn from racing. And I think the more years that you do it, the better off you'll be at never getting lost. I went the wrong way a lot of times in local races around here early.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm learning these lessons.
Yeah, you learn, you know. And I'm still learning. I probably should have put that shirt in that bag at Badger Mountain, you know. But the thing is, I didn't have crew, and because it's COVID and we couldn't go to aid stations, I didn't want to wait. My basic reasoning behind that, too, was that I did not want to wait for my drop bag to get back to the start-finish line because I knew I would have been done at 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. or something. So I was like, oh, screw it. I just won't put a shirt in it. And I'd break my toe, and I needed the shirt, you know. I would have walked to the finish to finish the thing had it not been real cold, but
yeah, right. Suck it up, Buttercup. I'm pretty sure that's what you said.
I mean, you know, just blink, it'll be over. I mean, whenever I run 100 mile now, I swear to God, it's like, you know, I kind of count it down as in the 10s, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, 50s, all the way to the end. And it goes by very, very fast. Sure, it hurts, but you knew it. I was like, I would see all across the valley and be like, oh, I got to go run back there. And then I'd be like, I'd get there and be like, oh, I'm here. You know, It just goes by fast. The older you get, the faster it goes. So remember that when you get older, time flies even faster.
Yeah. Man. Just the truth. Yeah, even this interview's flown by. Thank you so much for your time. Yeah, I really enjoyed talking to you. This was phenomenal. Yeah.
You know, anytime, just, you know, good luck at Coca-Cola. Wish I could see you out there, but I'll be watching to see how you all do. And just, you know, again, too, just stay positive. Remember that it's only one big effort. It's a couple days. And then when you're done, you'll be psyched. You know.
Yeah, I'm stoked. Tell me about it. Send me your address. I work for Gooder Sunglasses, so I'd love to send you some fresh shades, too.
Cool. Yeah, right on. I could use some shades. Small.
Okay.
Well, if that means anything, small lenses.
Got you.
So whatever, but yeah, that's great. Thank you very much. That's cool.
Yeah. Thank you. Have a great rest of your day. I hope you recover and get back out there soon.
All right. Right on, Shelby. It was great talking to you.
Thanks so much.
All right. That does it for today's episode. Thank you to our friend Shelby for doing these interviews. And thanks to our guests for sharing great training advice and insights into their own Coca-Dona race preparation. We've got a lot more trail running content coming your way soon. So be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a thing. And if you've got the time, consider leaving us a review. It really helps us out. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jamil Curry. See you on the next episode.